Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. 15 to 20 minutes of global news and analysis on tax havens and corruption you won't hear anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The TaxCast is available to everyone for download and broadcast on www.tackletaxhavens.com. Here's a quick roundup of some of this month's tax justice events. The Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, has published its long-awaited action plan to tackle corporate tax avoidance. But is it an inaction plan? We'll be discussing that later. India's changed its tax laws. Its tax officials say countries like Switzerland, United Arab Emirates, Hong Kong, Singapore, Samoa and Seychelles haven't been sharing information, effectively. India's putting a system in place so they can blacklist them if they don't behave themselves. Among other things, it means payments or transactions to a person or entity in the blacklisted country would be taxed at the highest rate. We'll be talking about Mexico's tax haven blacklist later. 21 African countries are set to sign the biggest tax treaty of its kind. The African Agreement on Mutual Assistance on Tax Matters means nations will work together to investigate the tax affairs of multinationals across the whole continent. In the US, Congress may not want to act against tax haven abuse, but the state of Oregon has. It's become the second state after Montana to pass legislation that means it can treat income companies listed in tax havens as domestic income, meaning Oregon can tax it. The bill was passed unanimously. Oregon State was losing an estimated $283 million a year because of offshore tax haven use by multinational corporations. And on this month's Roll of Dishonour, a dozen well-known French politicians may be feeling a bit worried this month. A former Swiss private bank executive has given the French Justice Department a list of names he says have undeclared Swiss accounts. The Tanzanian government brought into force a monthly tax on mobile phone SIM cards. Critics say it'll deny the poorest access to mobile communication services, a lifeline for many. The government says the tax will help develop the country, but as one MP argued in Parliament, if we really want money, we should stick to the mining companies. The Spanish Prime Minister's still managing to avoid interviews and any proper explanation to Parliament over an estimated $52 million his party treasurer hid in Swiss bank accounts. The Spanish Prime Minister has made one statement, though. He said, "Everything about me and my colleagues in the party is untrue, except for some things that have been published by some media outlets." Well, that clears things up then. The US is blocking reform plans of G20 countries like France, who want to close tax avoidance loopholes where digital economy companies like Google and Amazon pay no or low taxes. Seems the US wants tweaks rather than real change. And finally, in the low tax haven of Ireland, MPs voted not to question Google and Apple bosses over their tax affairs after all. Instead, they're going to have a watered-down inquiry into Ireland's tax policies. And that's the roundup for this month. Now I'm going to talk to Professor Alison Christians of Canada's McGill University for her take on this month. Okay, Alison. So I think this month we really have to talk about the OECD, who's published its long-awaited action plan to tackle corporate tax avoidance. So the Tax Justice Network and other campaigners have long accused the OECD of being a rich country club. The Tax Justice Network's been saying for the last 10 years that the global tax system wasn't fit for purpose, actually facilitating the erosion of tax revenue, and it needed radical reform. And I mean, much of it was devised back in the 1920s. So after years of resistance, the OECD is finally using the language and some of the ideas of the Tax Justice Network and other campaigners. There's at least two main drivers for this, I think. There's a fragmentation of tax rules happening because of the OECD's inaction for so many years and their efforts to preserve the status quo. Many developing countries and emerging economies have just simply taken matters into their own hands, and that's on the increase. And of course, recessions have now hit wealthier countries too, so they're a lot less able to afford the losses in tax revenue that they were. There is another issue, and that is that tax has become very much part of the public consciousness now, and it's not an issue that's going to go away. You've been watching and writing about the OECD for a long time. Are we seeing a shift in the attitude of the OECD here, do you think?
Well, I think you've adequately summed up the last 10 years of struggle. The big victory here is that the OECD is expanding its view of who the stakeholders are. So they're now explicitly understanding that they can't set up a working committee that includes the business community and the OECD community and then just ignore everybody else in the world and just create these standards and say, here's the global standard, now you all come and toe the line. The definition of stakeholders has to be a broader definition. So they start talking about the public and then some taxpayers and so on, and specifically mentioning non-governmental organizations. That is, the OECD recognizes that for it to retain its own institutional presence in the discussion, it can't be insular. It's got to be inclusive. But you see that they're talking now about including the G20 countries, and they've come up with a new term for them. Right now they're associates, so that's new. And then we're going to have invitees, ad hoc invitees as well. So that's an interesting development, and I actually think that might be the impetus for a broader conversation. It's hard to keep having the same conversation if you then invite people into the room who have already been having a different conversation, like Brazil, like China, like India. And they may just force a change in the conversation, even if the OECD is more or less wanting to go down the same path. That is, just let's strengthen transfer pricing, let's not talk about formulary apportionment. That might not be an option if you, in fact, open up that room to different stakeholders, which it looks like they see that being a necessity now. That's the way to go, but it is going to slow things down. It's clear, if you and I just tried to make a decision, we would just make a decision and it would take us a few hours and then it would be done. But if you're going to include 40 people or 100 people, then it's just going to take longer. And I do think, though, the decision's going to be better. That's the hope. And I certainly think that's why Tax Justice Network and others want to be involved in the decision making, because they do think they can improve the outcome of the decision making process.
Right, so we've had finance ministers from the G20 countries formally backing the OECD plan. And we should be clear that these ideas in the plan are recommendations. They're not binding on countries. And they're talking about some of the things that Tax Justice Network's advocated for years. So country by country reporting, so companies giving a breakdown of things like profit, sales, tax paid, staff on the ground. They're talking about attempts to tackle profit shifting for tax purposes. They're talking about trying to limit tax competition between nations. They're talking about making automatic information exchange a reality without further delay. So it all sounds very good, but how are they actually going to go about doing this? They're talking about getting all of this done by 2015, which is 2 years from now. Is that at all realistic? Is that reasonable?
Well, no, it's not going to be done in 2 years. My cynical side tells me nothing will happen, because as Tax Justice Network points out, there's too much resistance to change. And the stakeholders that are currently making the decisions understand that changes are not going to be in their favor.
So a lot of lobbying against these changes by interested industries. Some of these nations, like the UK, are putting in place the opposite of what they're now saying they're committing to in the OECD's plan, along with the rest of the G20. You've mentioned being a bit more inclusive with some of the big emerging economies like Brazil and India and China, but what about developing countries' smaller economies and, you know, some of the world's poorest nations?
Yeah, I don't think the OECD has anything to say to those countries. I don't think they ever have, and I don't think they concern themselves very much. Now, you can say, well, they have an arm that's expressly engaged in non-OECD countries, and they're doing the tax lawyers without borders, and they're trying to do these things. But what we've seen, I think, is the OECD is really just the wrong place to be making these decisions. This should be going on in the UN. And what's needed is to fund that through the UN, through the appropriate body, where inclusiveness is the order of the day. In the past, when you see the OECD doing things to try to prevent competition for its own institutional projects from the UN, from other institutions, that's a problem. That's a governance failure, I think. That's an institution trying to protect its own monopoly. That institution desperately wants to keep itself relevant.
For its own purposes. That's what institutions do, just like governments, anything else.
Right. So the Tax Justice Network, although it says the OECD plans generally to be welcomed as an immediate kind of fix to a really broken system that should produce some benefits, it's a bit like a sticking plaster. So the OECD is trying to strengthen the existing system, but they're still refusing to talk about unitary taxation formulary apportionment, which is one of the Tax Justice Network's recommendations for real root and branch reform. So trying to treat multinational corporations as unified firms under a central direction and tax them that way. They did also refuse for a long time to talk about some of the other proposals and solutions that people have been putting forward, including the Tax Justice Network. I'm just wondering, are we going to be in 10 years' time then seeing the OECD talking about unitary taxation? I mean, how long do these things take? Do we have to wait that long?
Can they continue to refuse to discuss unitary taxation? I'd be surprised if that was the case. What I think is that the space between experts deciding what the law ought to be and the public hearing about that and reacting to it and then putting pressure on it, that space is narrowing. And it's narrowing the more you get a diverse, broad spectrum of people in the decision-making process where you can't control the dialogue. And I think that's where you see the door opening here.
Professor Alison Christians from Canada's McGill University. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Stopping multinational corporations shifting their profits through low tax havens to minimise their tax bills is supposed to be a priority, both for developed and developing countries. This month, the TaxCast explores successful working models governments around the world have already implemented without the need for a single OECD, G20 or G8 summit. I'm talking today to Christian Mehta. He's a former partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers. He's currently on the advisory board of the Aspen Institute's Business and Society Programme and a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. He's working on a book at the moment with 20 other international tax experts on reforms that can be implemented by any nation that wants to stop profit shifting and other losses in tax revenue. So welcome to the TaxCast, Christian. I wonder if we can start with you first. You've had a very successful career. I'm just wondering what's motivating you now to work for Tax Justice?
Naomi, having come from a developing country myself, I can see what can be done if there were more tax revenues that could be effectively deployed to build infrastructure, schools, hospitals, to address issues of inequality and poverty. The technology and capital that businesses bring is part of the solution. We have an obligation here to build those bridges with companies and policymakers so that the good role that businesses can play through providing technology and capital that can further the development process can go forward in the right spirit and not be hindered. I'm inspired also by what John Ruskin used to say, that the underprivileged must find protection in the morality of the fortunate. I repeat, the underprivileged must find protection in the morality of the fortunate. We are the fortunate ones, and we have an obligation here. That is what I'm trying to do, and I think that's what we all in the tax justice community are trying to do.
Let's talk about some examples of really good practice that countries are following right now that could work as a very good example for other countries to implement.
Well, I'll give you a very good example of Japan, where I worked and practiced for 22 years. Japan has what is called the Tax Haven Countermeasure Law, or THCML, which applies to any Japanese subsidiary in a low-tax jurisdiction where the tax rate is 20% or less. Now, under this law, the Japanese parent is taxed currently on the undistributed earnings of the foreign subsidiary in these jurisdictions. So in other words, the income of any company that is set up in a low or no-tax jurisdiction for provision of copyrights, patent, leases, etc., cannot be excluded from current taxation. In other words, the tax haven use doesn't apply for Japanese companies. Now, we live in a very competitive world. Japanese multinationals have to compete with American multinationals, with European multinationals, and they are subject to this provision where they cannot use tax havens because all income on that is currently taxable. So I think Japan provides a good example of having a very clear and forthright law on ensuring that there is no abuse of tax havens by multinational companies that are headquartered in Japan. Now, Japan has another very interesting concept called the economic logic concept, or a test, which basically states that if any business carried on by a Japanese subsidiary in a low tax jurisdiction could reasonably be carried out in Japan, then the economic logic of them being offshore cannot be accepted. So a company has to meet this economic logic test and has to establish why they have to be in that jurisdiction in terms of business purpose and economic substance. And they also have to meet with the objectives of the tax haven countermeasure law. Those are not so easy to meet. And as a result, Japan is able to very successfully implement provisions that prevent the use or abuse of tax havens. So that, to me, is a perfect model. These very simple rules that Japan has adopted, and frankly, they go back to 78, 79, when these laws were put in place. So Japanese multinational companies have had to deal with these significant expectations from their authorities. And there's no reason why we have to think that exceptions have to be created for other multinational companies to give them the additional margin that comes from the use of these havens. Japan has proved as being a very vibrant economy. Until recently, it was the second largest economy in the world. It has proved that it can be done with these companies not needing to be in tax havens to be able to operate successfully and competitively around the world.
Tell us about Mexico, because they've got some very interesting provisions in place there, I believe.
Certainly, it's a perfectly good model that other countries can use to stem the abuse of trade mispricing and use of tax havens. It's called the Dictamen Fiscal Rule. Now, basically, under this rule, any transaction with low tax jurisdictions or a tax haven country cannot be allowed unless the company can establish that the transaction is bona fide. In other words, there has been no tax abuse. So the company has to provide documentation and information returns to the country concerned for any transaction with a tax haven country and any major transaction with an intra-company group. So the act of reporting that transaction with proper documentation under this provision is a significant one. But there's another very important part of that rule that other countries can consider. And that is that the CFO of the company and the statutory auditor have to attest or certify that the information provided by the company in their filings is valid and accurate, and there has been no transfer pricing abuse. So not only the information has to be reported, but an attestation has to be done by the company and by the auditor concerned. Now, just this very simple rule has done a lot to stem transfer pricing abuse in Mexico.
Right, so it's a huge deterrent for companies to indulge in that kind of transaction in the first place if they're going to have to go and report the details of that.
You know, in a typical case, the audit expense for the company concerned in that jurisdiction, like in Mexico, would be a little higher than for other countries. But auditors are actually also prefer to be in the position of certifying or attesting because the fiduciary burden has also been put on the company concerned, that the information is complete and it's accurate. Companies don't want to risk losing their license in those countries, the audit firms and so forth. So they are happy to see a provision like this in place because it encourages more forthright and integral actions by the company concerned. It provides for a number of eyes to look at a transaction in a way to confirm that there has been no abuse. And while the cost may go up, it certainly has many benefits. And the likelihood of any audits then taking place by the developing country concerned become less in light of this attestation. So that has worked amazingly well in Mexico. It has been adopted in Canada by some other Latin American countries. And frankly, it's something that should be adopted by many countries in Africa, in Asia, and is a rule that is a very good model available to all of us.
And Mexico operates a tax haven blacklist as well, doesn't it? Tell us about that.
Mexico maintains a list, a blacklist, of 50 to 60 tax haven countries. And automatically, any transaction with those countries is subject to an audit or requiring an information return of this nature. So the very fact that they keep an updated list of these tax havens, they require the companies to report transactions with those countries, they require the auditors to sign, clearly has resulted in a reduction. And the fact that it has been picked up as a model by other countries is also saying something about its bona fides and its validity.
Krishna, I wonder if you can tell me a bit about safe harbours and advanced pricing agreements, or APAs. Countries can and do already implement these measures, don't they, without waiting on the OECD or the G20 or the G8. And they'd be pretty useful for countries like the UK too, trying to get taxes out of companies like Google, Amazon and Starbucks.
Well, I think both safe harbours and APAs tie together, and let me elaborate on both. Safe harbours basically put a cap or limits on what is allowable or not allowable as a deduction by multinational companies. Similarly, an advanced pricing agreement puts an exact percentage on how much profit that the company is making on a project will be payable in taxes to the country concerned. Now, you've seen a lot of reports about excessive management charges. There could be a cap, say, of 2% that could be charged. There could be a cap on royalty payments, patents and copyrights, say 5% that could be charged. There could be a cap on interest expenses on intra-company loans. We have heard of many instances in which exorbitant interest expenses are charged among intra-company loans, which strip out a lot of income from developing countries. Then even on intangibles, safe harbors can be agreed upon in advance so that based upon market practices and audit experience, there are fixed amounts that can be payable to an MNC. And this way, the developing country is more in control of what exactly are the payments being made, rather than being at the receiving end of what payments the company decides to make. And these safe harbors are codified in their law, and it's something that the companies understand and accept before they invest in that country, so that there's no possibility or risk or concern about extended litigation or administrative costs on the company side or audit costs on the developing country side. Basically, there is simplicity and certainty for both sides. Starbucks, Amazon, Google and others, the key for UK, France, other European countries is going to be in trying to establish what would be the appropriate charge that can be made to those jurisdictions for the intangibles that we're talking about, for the management fees, royalties and so forth.
Which in Starbucks' case were inflated.
Inflated. So if these countries had a cap on it or a limit of 5% that could be allowable for a royalty payment or a management fee of 2% or 4% and so forth, then the likelihood of using these offshore headquartered companies to charge high amounts, which they then could perhaps justify through very elaborate economic studies and so forth, ending up with long-term audits, all of that doesn't help the European economies in any way. Having a very simple determination as to what would be a fair charge would then provide some parameters for these companies in terms of how much would be the maximum deduction that is allocable to any jurisdiction, and the rest of it would need to be taxable in the country concerned.
You've been listening to Krishan Mehta talking to me, Naomi Fowler, on The Taxcast, the Tax Justice Network's monthly podcast. You can hear the full interview and other features and interviews on our Tax Justice Network channel on www.youtube.com/tackletaxhavens. For more Taxcasts, you can now find us on iTunes or go to www.tackletaxhavens.com. We'll be back with more news and analysis next month.